I'm not sure. But here you go. Robert Jones, Peace and Social Justice. For me, I'll see you again next week. Enjoy your weekend. And, you know, take care. Bye-bye.
This is an encore presentation of the Peace and Social Justice Program, originally broadcast on December 16th, 2022.
What happens to the values of our educational system when capitalism and the bottom line get stitched into the fabric of K-12, college, and universities, like our own Chico State? We'll have a roundtable discussion with three university educators about academic capitalism and the degenerative effects of neoliberalism on the academy. But first up, with nighttime temperatures in Chico now dipping below the freezing mark, we'll speak with the executive director of Safe Space Winter Shelter about their providing seasonal, low-barrier emergency shelter for people experiencing homelessness here in Chico. Stick around. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with Century 21 Select, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with kind, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 893-4923.
With winter temperatures dipping below freezing here in Chico, our unhoused neighbors have challenges with shelter, especially at night. I'm joined by the executive director of Safe Space Winter Shelter, Hillary Crosby, to talk about these issues. Hillary, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Safe Space.
So Hillary, if you can, just tell us a little bit for listeners who have, there are listeners who probably have no idea what Safe Space is or how it works or what volunteering for Safe Space is about. First of all, if you can give us just a little background on Safe Space and your role in Safe Space.
Sure, thank you. So Safe Space is primarily volunteer ran. I am the first paid executive director for Safe Space. I started earlier this year. And we do include some paid shelter monitors for the season. But otherwise, we're largely based with just a huge volunteer pool of amazing people that come together at this time to provide a low barrier shelter. So I'll kind of like maybe go into that a little bit. Low barrier is basically we're just taking people as they are. So we don't have any, guests are not required to take a drug and alcohol test. They don't have to adhere to any religious beliefs or anything to access the shelter. We don't deny, entrance to the shelter if someone's under the influence. Everything we do is based on behavior. So as long as people can act right, they are welcome to stay the night. And that's just kind of how our philosophy works. And it's been very well received. We rarely have issues at our shelter at night. So staffers there to make sure, people are safe and everyone has what they need to settle in for the night. We use a model right now, we don't have our own building, of course. So we have really great partnerships with our local churches in the Chico area that support us and open their doors to us for a week or two at a time. And we have a rotating shelter model where we have have a centralized intake center, which this year we were able to partner with the Jesus Center, and we just locked down an intake center on Fair Street. So it's 2300 Fair Street, and it's one of the older buildings there that was the Work Training Center property. And we'll be able to stay there for the 10 weeks of our shelter, and individuals will go there at like about 5:30 in the evening. They'll get checked in. They keep what they need for the night, and then the rest of their property gets stored. And then we shuttle people back over to the shelters. So, that it's about 35 to 50 people a night, depending on, you know, what our facility looks like, what our, attendance is. And, then we serve them dinner, and then they settle in for the night. And most people just kind of go right to sleep and get warm. And then the next morning, we then shuttle them back to certain drop-off points for the day, and whatever their day looks like. So that's kind of the high level of what we do for Safe Space. And like I said, we're going to go for about 10 weeks through the end of February, as long as we can. So that's our goal, is to make it the 10 weeks.
If you're unhoused and you want to spend an evening or maybe a number of evenings, you said it's going to be going for 10 weeks. Where do unhoused folk, where do they go, or who do they contact? How would that work? What are the mechanics of that?
Yeah, so 211 is something that I'm always pushing people to keep in their tool belt of resources. So 211, we communicate very frequently with 211, any changes that might happen with the shelter. 211 also has a text line that a lot of people who are unhoused have signed up for, and it kind of pushes out information for them as well. So the information about shelter will be going out to them via that text notifications. But anyone can call 211 and find out the location of the shelter in case they forget. So the reason kind of that we do one centralized intake is because we do rotate. So it's really hard to remember, oh, wait, you were there yesterday, but now you've moved, and where am I supposed to go tonight? And it also allows us to use a broader range of churches in the community, because we can kind of eliminate that transportation barrier. So people just go right to Fair Street. They check in 5:30, intake lasts till about 7. So we really want to get people there as close to 5:30 as we can. Start getting people shuttled over to the location for the night. Once their property's stored, we have a secure property truck that we keep their stuff on for the night. And then they're, bussed over to our shelter. So that's kind of our, all they need to remember is to go to the intake center at 2300 Fair Street. It's right across the street from the Jesus Center. And that's where they go every night. And they're welcome to come. You know, we want people to stay with us as long as they need to. So their spot is secured. We really want, if you're going to come every night, we want to eliminate as much anxiety of that as we can that they have a spot. Cause like you said, if your blankets get damp, maybe it's rainy, maybe it's, the dew or the frost is on you and your blankets are, they really have a hard time finding ways to get those dry. And then it just can make, that we've all been there when we get that bone feeling cold and you just can't get warm. That's not a good spot to be in. And so, that is a struggle for our unhoused people. And, so we want to, we wish we could be, 365 days a year for sure. But this is the little bit that we're able to help. And we do rely on volunteers a lot. There's a bunch of moving parts to our operation. So whether it be registration, coming, helping people get checked in for the night. Are you on the list? Do we have your basic information here? And we don't require a lot of information to stay. Again, we want to keep this as low barrier as possible. So our bottom line is, let's give you a safe place to stay for the night, get you a good meal. Then we store property. We need people to help with putting property on the truck, getting it in bags. It is tagged, so every person's stuff, they sort through their property themselves. We don't, we want to maintain respect and dignity for people and let them, get their stuff stored. And then, And then we have a shuttle driver that is, getting people over. And then at the shelter itself, this is a really good opportunity for maybe people who are new volunteers to Safe Space is being a volunteer for the evening. It's just a 2-hour shift. We show up at the church for that night and just kind of, it's a hospitality role. You know, you kind of make sure people have what they need. We give people bedding and a mat, to sleep on. And so you're just kind of getting that out to them. Do they need anything? You know, maybe people aren't feeling well. Maybe they need some Advil. Maybe they, you know, need some Benadryl. We try and keep some basic first aid stuff on hand just to kind of try and meet any immediate needs that we can do. So that's kind of what that role is, as well as we're serving people dinner. We are kind of late in the season trying to pull our meal schedule together. So, that's a great opportunity. We're really looking for people to help with meals. I think we've got our schedule pretty locked down until, the end of December. But if people are interested that first week of January, we have a meal coordinator that's helping us out right now, a volunteer. So you're welcome to email or reach out on our website or social media. Let us know you're interested. We'd love to get businesses maybe, if you have coworkers, you have a friend group that wants to get together. The other thing is breakfast. So people stay the night, we're able to serve them. Maybe volunteers come in, they serve dinner. The next morning we have to get up bright and early. So 6 o'clock, 6 to 8, we have to be out of our churches by 8 o'clock for the most part. So we're getting people up and out the door back to wherever they're going. And it's still cold at 8 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning when we're dropping people off. So we do try and send them with a little breakfast bag. Maybe it's a muffin, maybe it's some string cheese and some, fruit for the, get them started for the day. So that's another way that people can volunteer. If you'd like to make, donate some stuff for breakfast bags, that's always welcome. Those things matter to get your day started off right, at least on a better foot, because It's rough at 6 a.m. getting people out the door, for sure. I don't even like to get out of the house at 6 a.m.
So. Right. That's the voice of Hillary Crosby. She's the executive director of Safe Space Winter Shelter. And yes, on a topic of volunteering, and we here at KZFR, the public affairs folks and others have volunteered to be meal providers at various times over the years. For those listeners who do want to volunteer, it seems like there are different roles. There's meal providers. There's kind of like core volunteers. Aren't there trained volunteer positions? So for example, I guess what I'm thinking of is, let's say that we have a listener who wants to volunteer and they say, well, I can put in 2 hours, but I don't really know what to do if there's any kind of upset or something. So it's not like someone volunteers and they're sort of just thrown into this situation. There are always trained volunteers who are experienced with these kinds of things, right?
That's true. So we're blessed to have a bunch of people that have volunteered with us for years. So they know how it works. They know the ropes. And so we put them into people kind of move through, I guess, our system a little bit. So you're a new volunteer, and then maybe next year, you really enjoyed it, and now you kind of move into what we call our core volunteers, and they're ones that can kind of help mentor new ones. We do have basic checklists too that are there for people to know kind of, like a little mini job description, kind of what's being asked of you. And so we have the ability to take a wide range of volunteers, whether you've never volunteered before, this is your first night. We're going to make you feel secure. We're going to make you feel safe. Make sure you know what your job is and that you're never left by yourself. You are there with a team. And so in whatever position that is, you're going to be there with other people that are volunteering, our core volunteers, as well as our shop manager. So once you become a core volunteer, we have a team of 5 that are kind of in a leadership role, and they are on call every night for any behavioral issues that might come up, any safety issues, any medical issues. Because, we got to be honest, the people on the street are medically fragile, and a lot of seniors. And sometimes we do have medical emergencies that we need to take care of. And that is where our staff, our paid staff, are there for the night too. And they've kind of also worked through the system of volunteering and then became paid staff. So a lot of trained, seasoned people there to support the operations, make sure our volunteers, kind of have support there. So Don't be nervous. Just jump in there. Maybe you're off at 4 o'clock every Tuesday, see if you could pick up a role once a week or something for a month or for the season. It's nice to kind of get consistency. Our staff kind of have set days too. So, you might work with the same team, over and over again, if that's a role that you like. So lots of ways to volunteer and make sure that we're supporting them too.
Well, Hillary Crosby, you certainly are a hero, or should I say a shero of the Chico community. How can listeners who want to volunteer, however they want to volunteer, there's all different ways to volunteer, as you mentioned. How can they reach you? How can they reach Safe Space? Who can they contact?
We have many ways. So our website, you can go to the tab that says contact us and just send an email. It actually goes into my email. A couple of us manage that inbox there, so you'll get a response right away. info@safespacechico.org. Also our social media, you're welcome to message us on Instagram or on Facebook. We watch those regularly and we'll respond. Donations as well. As we get kind of rolling through the season, we'll be posting things that we may need. So, keep an eye on that. Sometimes we need laundry soap, or sometimes we need some random things, that maybe that's a quick trip to Costco. You can just grab that, for us or something. There's, like you said, there's a million ways that people can support this effort. Obviously financially is always great. Sometimes it's easy to get donations or grants for things, but staff time is also important. That's how we make our program safe and run effectively. So financial donations are always welcome as well. And we have a fund at North Valley Community Foundation. So people are welcome to, go on their site and donate direct to our fund. On our website, we have multiple options to our address to mail checks, PayPal. We have Venmo. We have lots of ways. So yes, I appreciate you guys supporting us. I appreciate the community. That is one thing I've got to say, is I've been blown away by the amount of support that Safe Space gets, whether we're doing the cooling center in the summer or we're doing the winter shelter, in extreme cold. Our community really comes out and supports our population, and that just warms my heart, because yes, these are our most vulnerable people, and they need us, and they need to be treated with dignity and respect, and just shown a lot of love. And that's kind of what we do. So that's exciting. I'm happy.
So the website is safespacechico.org.
Correct.
And that's, just go there, and everything you could want to know about the organization you can find. Hillary Crosby, again, thank you for the work you're doing for the community. And we look forward to, teams of volunteers rushing to help and to, lend a hand in this. Like I said, it really is a noble cause, helping the most vulnerable of our neighbors here in Chico. But Hillary, thank you so much. And thank you for your time. Thanks for taking some time out from your busy schedule to speak with us on the Peace and Social Justice Show.
Thank you for having me.
It's one thing to love community radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that's simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KZFR. It's easy for you. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Here's how to get started. Go to kzfr.org/cardonate or call 888-593-7288.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar uses products from local farms and ranches to support community agriculture. Open every day for lunch and dinner with curbside pickup at 2359 The Esplanade in Chico. For details, find Farmstar Pizza on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Burchard Construction, providing custom remodels, new residential and commercial building, from foundation to finish. Burchard Construction, where the homeowner's input matters. Custom construction with beauty and function. Bids, consultations, and employment opportunities at 530-864-5427 and at burchardconstruction.com. If you enjoy this program, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show.
I'm joined today via Zoom by three guests. Dr. John Sanbonmatsu is Associate Professor of Philosophy in the Department of Humanities and Arts at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, where he teaches classes in ethics, philosophy of technology, and existentialism and phenomenology, among other topics. Professor Sanbonmatsu received his PhD in the History of Consciousness program at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He is the author of The Postmodern Prince, A Critique of Post-Structuralism and an Attempt to Reconstitute Left Social Theory, and editor of the book Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. His new book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life, will be published next year by NYU Press. John Sanbonmatsu is president of his university chapter of the American Association of University Professors. I'm also joined by Dr. Troy Jollimore. Dr. Jollimore is professor of philosophy at California State University, Chico. His research focuses on ethics, love and loyalty, and philosophy of literature. Professor Jollimore has published three books of philosophy and four books of poetry. His recognitions include fellowships from the Stanford Humanities Center and the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. I'm also joined by Dr. Peter S. Fossil. Professor Fossil is professor of philosophy at Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky. Professor Fossil's work explores the history of skepticism and skeptical life. Professor Fossil's publications include Hume's Skepticism, The Big Lebowski and Philosophy, and The Philosopher's Toolkit, the last of which now appears in its third edition and eight languages. Professor Fossil was appointed the David Hume Fellow of the University of Edinburgh's Institute for Advanced Study in the Humanities and received the Acorn Award, Kentucky's highest honor for a professor at a four-year university. Professor Fossil is also a Kentucky colonel. Well, thank you to John, Troy, and Peter for joining us on the Peace and Social Justice program today.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks for having us.
So, John Sanbonmatsu, let's start with you, this issue of the academy. And by the academy, I mean, I think it's okay today to talk about focus our subject at post-secondary education. But this phenomenon we're going to talk about today, it goes all the way down to, all the way to grade school. So the whole sort of neoliberalization of education in general in the United States is an issue. But John, if you can lay out for us the basic kind of conceptual framework to frame this discussion of what is neoliberalism and the academy and what the heck? There's people who are listening who don't even know, like, what is this subject that we're even talking about, neoliberalism and the academy? And it actually affects all of us, anyone who is, goes to school in the United States. So, John Sanbonmatsu, can you start out and just give us a little foundation?
Sure. There's an idealized conception of academia, from the university system as a place for the disinterested pursuit of knowledge and truth and justice and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's a kind of story that lies behind the story that I'm going to be telling. And it is a story. I mean, it's the university has always been a much more complex place than that. And, you know, I like to think of it as having an ambiguous status in society on the one hand, being a place where critical voices, critical inquiry, has been taking place for many centuries. And at the same time, the university has been a very pivotal institution in reproducing, the power of society. And so it's never been an uncontaminated space. And yet it has, it does have this critical dimension and this sense of being a place where, ideas can flow, where a community of scholars can meet, where education of the young you know, broad humanistic education as possible and so forth. So there is there's more than a grain of truth to this more noble, idealized conception that we have of academia, going back all the way to Plato in the fourth century BCE, when, you know, Plato founded the original academy. Now, listeners may be wondering, like, who the hell cares? You know, who cares what goes on in universities? They're just a bunch of elitists, know-it-alls who are, you know, doing all these bizarre things in the classroom, like critical race theory or whatever. And in fact, you know, there's a large segment of the American population that's now been kind of acculturated into a right-wing propaganda that portrays academics as out of touch with reality and so on. And this discourse actually goes back quite a ways. Richard Hofstadter wrote a very famous essay several decades ago on the paranoid style in American politics, right, which was where he talked about the anti-intellectualism in American culture. So that goes back, a kind of suspicion of experts. But actually what's happening in the university matters a great, as you said, you know, it matters a great, great deal. It matters a great deal for the disinterested pursuit of knowledge and the interested pursuit of knowledge. In other words, just free inquiry and inquiry that's meant to make a difference in the world. And it makes a difference for our democracy, what happens in the university. So there are a lot of complex issues here. But in terms of the topic for today, I'm sorry to go into so much detail, but we're talking about a phenomenon we could call the neoliberalization of education, as you put it, or the corporatization of the university. And basically, the university has become a kind of corporation. I mean, it's literally run now by chief executives, some of whom don't necessarily have any background in university life at all. They're not academics. They don't actually know anything about education. But, of course, this is how capitalism works. You know, the CEOs or board of directors, people float from board to board to board, and they don't know anything about gasoline or you know, agriculture, whatever. They just, they're managers of capital. And so what happens to, the question is like kind of what happens to education and to human beings and to democracy when universities become essentially corporations. That is to say, when knowledge is treated as a commodity, when the people who work in the university are treated as workers to be exploited, meaning staff and faculty, and when students are seen as simply customers of education, right? So, as I say, there are a lot of currents that brought us to this point. But I will just point to a couple of little good things that went on. One is that beginning in the 70s, which is kind of when we date neoliberalism. And neoliberalism, I should say for your audience, is a phase of late capitalism. As I say, it's a kind of strategy for capital accumulation within this larger system. So part of what we're doing today, I think, the things that we're going to be talking about or are talking about, they're not just about, quote, neoliberalism. They're about capitalism. Okay. It's very important. People use neoliberalism as a synonym for capitalism today. But without talking about capitalism, you know, you hear a lot of people bashing at neoliberalism, but actually they're talking about capitalism. So we're talking about the effects of capitalism on educational life. Yeah. And so what happened was that in the 70s, the state, the federal government began to defund higher education. And this, you know, goes back to kind of the philosophy, economics, political economy of the Chicago School of Economics, Nixon administration beginning to play with market mechanisms in higher ed. But really what it has to do with is shifting the burden of education to the cost of that to individual families, and the state kind of, you know, putting everybody in a Lord of the Flies environment where parents have to, you know, kids have to compete for scarce Pell Grants and so forth. And so society's commitment to higher education, and when I say society, I mean through the state, that kind of begins to dissipate, to disappear. And so over time, this is again 70s, 80s, and then onward, universities had to scramble to find new sources of revenue. And the because the U.S. was losing its competitive advantage internationally, economically in the 80s to Japan and Germany, there was a feeling that, well, we need to invest in technological development. And so higher education became distorted towards STEM, right? Now, every school in America has a STEM program. Meanwhile, they're gutting the humanities components and social sciences and performing arts and
so John, forth. Can you just tell us what STEM is for those listening?
STEM stands for science, technology, engineering. Thank you, and mathematics. Yeah, sometimes they throw in the arts, so it becomes STEAM. But it's typically STEM, and there are just billions of dollars out there in private and public funding for that. So there's been again kind of a larger shift away from state support for education, government support, and pressures to move towards R&D, research and development, technology transfer agreements like the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980. Which commodified knowledge, made it easier for professors in the sciences to turn their research into commodities rather than for the public good. You know, so there's a loss of the public good. Neoliberalism, getting back to neoliberalism, because this is just part of a larger, historical global transformation where there's a rollback of the welfare state, quote unquote, you know, and an attack on organized labor. So organized labor had this kind of golden era, the post-war period, where workers they saw their earnings grow enormously, and workers could afford a home with one person making, a salary. And education was part of that, higher education. After the war, there was this huge expansion in public education and education generally. So that was the university was key to reproducing the workforce. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling here, but I want to make one last point and see if folks want to jump in here. But I just want to note that the corporatization of the university, the running of the corporation as a university, has enormously important consequences for the way knowledge and truth circulate in society. Right. And what we're seeing now partly is the critical function of the intellectual, which goes back a long way, is being severely compromised. It was under attack by, from external sources, political right, but also because of this commodification process and bureaucratization and so forth. There's been a rise of other sources of knowledge due to digital media, right? So you and I, all of us on this in this discussion, are competing against people like Joe Rogan and so forth. So knowledge producers, there's a sense in which intellectuals are suffering from forced obsolescence. As a consequence of these institutional forces. And this in turn has led to, and Peter maybe can speak to this, but to an epistemic crisis in society. As I say, people, we don't share the same common views of the world. And one of the things that intellectuals used to do, especially the quote, universal intellectual, one who kind of had a function of being a social critic and made people think about certain problems. For example, Herbert Marcuse in the 1960s, very a controversial figure for sure, but also widely read and widely debated. There's less, there's the fragmentation of society has led to a fragmentation of knowledge. That is a direct function of capital, right? In Communist Manifesto, Marx famously says, all that is solid melts into air. Well, what melts into air is the ground of truth itself, right? And so, after the 60s movements kind of began to collapse, social movements, there was a kind of migration of intellectuals into the university. you know, leftists and so forth. And, you know, kind of the last ice flow passing by to jump to while everything else kind of collapses. And now that's being attacked as well. So it's very dangerous for society that we are, that there's almost no space left in civil society for critical reflection, free inquiry, or for the young to be exposed to perspectives that they wouldn't get otherwise because of the propaganda system.
You're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Chico, California.
We're in conversation with Professor John Sanborn Matsu, and we're talking about neoliberalism and the academy here on the Peace and Social Justice Show. Before I invite our other guests in, I wanted to just, I was scratching down some notes this morning, and with regard to neoliberalism, because I think it's a kind of, as you mentioned, John, it's actually, you know, it's a manifestation of capitalism. But in jotting down some notes, I thought the following kinds of, the main points, if you will, of neoliberalism to help people. Because I think for some people, neoliberalism, I'll go through these five very quickly, but they're just sort of an assumption about a way of life that, like, the question would be, is there another way of life? So what I jotted down were the following with regard to neoliberalism, and that is the rule of the market, right? The free market is the sort of arbiter of all that is good. Cutting public expenditures for social services. So social services get eliminated. Of course, deregulation. Everything must be deregulated. The other one is privatization, right? So privatizing, and this reflects on what we're talking about with regard to education, the privatization, state-owned enterprises are privatized. They're good. They're gone. And the other thing is, and this is important, a kind of elimination of the notion of the public good, right? So seeing education as a public good, or seeing anything as a public good, under the neoliberal lens, that idea goes away. And so we have this individuals, as you mentioned, the Lord of the Flies, individuals versus individuals, and I get mine, and, you know, as much as I can get. So those are some of the points that I was thinking about with regard to the way that we conceptualize neoliberalism. And as I mentioned, I think these aspects that I just went through, for many people, that they just figure that's just a way of life, right? Like, what would it mean not to have, what would it mean to have a notion of a public good? Whereas, of course, throughout history, especially at the university level, the notion of the public good drove a lot of these kinds of policies. So let me invite Professor Peter Fossil in. Peter, gain your insights into this question, respond to John, or some of your own insights with regard to the sort of corporatization of education, the neoliberalization of academia. What are your views on that?
You know, it's hard to add anything to what John says. He's so insightful and comprehensive about things. I'm at a small liberal arts college, and in Kentucky, maybe things look a little different here. If I were to add to what John said, I'd say, and what you said too, Robert, is I think it's important to keep in mind that neoliberalism in the academy is of a piece with neoliberalism more broadly. And when I see the changes that happen in the academy, I also think of what's happened to the labor movement in the United States, and what's happened to the arts more generally, what's happened to media, what's happened to government. I mean, labor unions have been eviscerated. I think, labor unions represent something like 5% of the labor force now, maybe even less. Major media are not, you know, corporately controlled. Speech is largely under, you know, private control now. The government is captured in many ways. It's not quite the site of of a contest of classes, or the interests are largely capitalist interests fighting it out in the government. Even religion has become more conservative. I mean, Louisville, where I live, is the home of Southern Baptist Seminary, and Southern Baptists used to be actually pretty progressive back in the day, and they become, as you know now, exceedingly conservative. And so I think it's important to keep all of that in mind, especially because what's happening in the academy is not happening in isolation from broader things. And it's happening to our students, too. I mean, Kentucky's not a wealthy state. And so many of our students are first generation, and they're looking to universities as a stepping stone into the middle class or into stable jobs. But it's job markets that are increasingly precarious and volatile and have fewer and fewer benefits to offer. And they're facing university education that's increasingly expensive. I saw some of the most expensive universities now in the U.S. are, close to $80,000 per year, 1 year, right? And student debt is now, exceeding 30. It's like the average American student is approaching, I think, $30,000 in debt when they graduate. It's incredible. So I think to understand what's happening in the academy, we have to place it in that larger context. And you mentioned, too, resistance. So I think it's true. I don't, there's always been friction between, the academy and the larger society. I mean, Socrates was prosecuted and put to death. Remember what the charges were? Corrupting the young, challenging the established gods, or to say pieties of society. So in a way, that's an old story. You hear the same things happening today. The way it's happening, as John's pointed out, is, what's distinctive. Even Plato's academy was outside the city walls. I mean, so it had an ambiguous relationship with the city. And I think there's always often been a tension there. That's partly to our credit, because we can position ourselves as critics. But the system doesn't want critics. It doesn't want dissent. And so spaces where there is a place where dissent and criticism and resistance can be generated are going to be attacked and undermined and weakened and marginalized, etc. One question I think we ought to ask before we finish the show, I hope, too, is, though, how have we academics contributed to that? We often position ourselves as passive victims of neoliberalism. I don't know. I think that's a little bit too easy on us, and so maybe we might talk about that later. But that's larger context, going back to Socrates, and also for what's happening to all kinds of institutions. I mean, it does. Let me, the last thing I want to say about that is, it creates a situation where you have a bunch of fish in the water who don't. The last thing they're going to notice is the water, right? I mean, Marx said that the dominant ideas of a society, the ideas of the dominant class, they become so dominant that people can't. It's almost a crisis of imagination. It's not just the criticism that we offer in the humanities, anyway. It's the capacity to imagine something different. So people often point out about all these like post-apocalyptic movies that like it's easier to imagine the end of the world in America, anyway, America corporate entertainment, than it is to imagine socialism or anarchism or some kind of other economic system. And that's, I don't know if by design, but that's been the result, I think, of a very sustained campaign to manage criticism, imagination, speech, ideas, we're stuck with it right now, anyway.
That's the voice of Professor Peter Fossil. We're having a discussion about neoliberalism and the sort of corporatization of education, in particular the academy. I want to invite now Professor Troy Jollimore. Troy, you've been listening to John and Peter, and I'm wondering what your experiences have been. I know that you and I have spoken about the topic of the corporatization of education. So, yeah, where are you coming from on this?
I teach, as you do, at a big state school, and from that perspective, I see this coming in a number of ways. It's not one thing, it's not a single thing we must contend with. It's, and this I think speaks to what Peter was just saying, neoliberal ideas have so soaked into the way things are approached right now and thought about and evaluated, that we face it on every level, so much so. I mean, thinking about Peter's phrase, what he just used, the crisis of the imagination. And Robert, what you said a few minutes ago when you're talking about defining neoliberalism, you began by saying, look, a lot of people just say, well, this just is the way things are, right? Is there even another way? I think, you know, John said that when we're talking about neoliberalism here, we're talking about capitalism. This is a phase of capitalism. And it's hard to define, and it's a contested definition, to be sure. I personally tend to think that one of the things that typifies this particular stage is precisely that these ideas are no longer ideas with a lot of power, but which are still debated and are somewhat controversial and so on, but that they simply are assumed as the obvious ideas. They become a kind of common sense. So you could go back a few decades and you could see similar ideas to a lot of these: free market this, deregulation that, and so on. Social Darwinism, sink or swim, you know, there were certainly proponents of those ideas, and enough proponents in enough influential places that they had a big effect on society. But I still don't think you would find what I so often find now, which is that when I try to say, look, this isn't the way things have to be, and in fact, I think there's something quite wrong about these ideas, not only to university administrators or bureaucrats in general, who we might expect to have swallowed a lot of these, this Kool-Aid, but to my fellow academics and other faculty members, and certainly, and a lot of time to my students as well. You know, when I talk about this stuff in class, I can look at students' faces and see that there are this small number who are sort of hearing what I'm saying. And there's kind of a couple who are nodding like, yeah, we're there already. We get it, you know, but then so many just, I don't think they can hear what I'm saying. It just doesn't make sense. If you get up and say, look, there's other ways of evaluating things besides in terms of money and profit, that idea is so alien to so many people right now that they can't even really hear it. They don't get it. And something sort of closes down in them rather than opening up and considering it. They haven't given the tools to consider it. You know, so John also said something, I think this is so important, right, about how dangerous this is, partly because universities ought to be one of the places, and perhaps the main place, where people get exposed to contrary ideas. And right now, that's not happening. It needs to happen more than ever. But so many of university administrators and faculty and so on have bought into these ideas themselves that there's nothing for students to come up against. They're not going to find these alternative ideas. I think most of our students, at least at a place like this, and I don't think we're that unusual, honestly. I think at a school like this, most of our students get through their education, so-called, get their degree, and never get exposed to anything that is in any meaningful way opposed to the basic idea that, for instance, and I really think this is in a lot of ways the dominant idea here, that it's a claim about evaluation, that evaluation must reduce to money, that at the end of the day, everything gets judged in terms of profit. How else could you possibly evaluate anything? That seems to be, again, so many people's attitude right now. And it's partly this result of, again, a lack of imagination. It's partly the result of a certain sort of skepticism. It even can take a democratic form. Like, look, it's fair because the whole idea of the free market in some people's minds is that you're letting everybody have a say, in essence. And the people that spend the most money in a certain place, it's like they're voting for something. And so those things should get the most. They're obviously the most valuable. So, of course, what this leads to is something John mentioned, briefly, and I wanted to come back to because it's so much of my personal experience of neoliberalism in the university. And that's this model of student as customer, which I think is so harmful in so many ways. And again, is so rapidly achieving dominance. I just see it in emails that our administration sends out completely unreflectingly, right? Again, they're not saying, hey, let's treat our students as customers. Like, they have to convince us. It's just the language that they use that shows that they are already assuming that, of course, that's what we're doing. Just like people in the shoe business are selling shoes, people in the education racket obviously are selling education to customers. And I think that, let me just mention two really big ways in which I think this is really harmful. First of all, it really distorts what should be the actual relationship between students and their professors, which I think is much more complex, and is much more respectful in a way, and is much more a matter of, for instance, you know, if I think of myself as primarily trying to please the customer and achieve customer satisfaction, then I'm going to try not to upset the customer or try to challenge them or anything like that. If you're selling shoes, then if somebody comes in and wants to buy shoes, you don't talk with them for a while and then say, I don't know if shoes are right for you. I don't know if shoes are really what you need. Maybe you should go down the street and get something else that might be better for you. But I think as an educator, a lot of the time, I mean, I don't think I'm going to tell very many people education in general isn't right for them. But in terms of evaluating what they're aiming at, their desires, their life goals, even perhaps what they want to study and so on, I'm going to be giving them ideas that are going to challenge all of those things. I'm going to be trying to get them to really question their fundamental presuppositions. That's very alien to the way we would treat customers if we regarded them as customers. But I think it's necessary if we're going to be actual decent educators. The other really harmful thing, I'll end with this for now, but again, this throws back to something that John was talking about in terms of the incredible financial restructuring of college funding and so on, and the incredible cost of current college education, the amount of debt that the average student carries and so on. This, again, is largely supported by the customer, the student as customer model. Because, of course, if we think of the student as customer, the natural way to think of it is they're the ones that are buying something from us. They're the ones that are walking away with this very valuable thing, namely an education. And so they're the ones that should have to pay for it. They're the student as customer. They show up, they buy a product, they're going to pay for the product. That's how customer relations work. And again, I think, look, the truth is much different. All of us benefit when somebody gets educated. It's not only the student that benefits. All of us benefit. I am able to live a reasonably decent life in large part because I'm surrounded by enough people who have been educated enough that they can do the things that they need to do. That, you know, for instance, there aren't enough doctors, but at least there's close to enough doctors that to this point have managed to find medical care when I needed it and so on. I have experts to consult. I have people writing books that are extremely important to my own intellectual life. I have all these people doing things I don't know how to do, but they know how to do because they've been educated to do it. And in a more general way, hopefully, at least, you know, if I was in a better society, it'd be easier to say this, but if you're in a real society where people are educated and so on, you can count on people to be reasonable and not do crazy things and make at least generally overall good decisions, etc., in ways that we really need as human beings. We are so dependent on other people in ways that it's very easy to forget. You know, it's very easy for us to fall into that myth of sort of the I built it myself myth. You know, everything I have, I did for myself. I achieved it on my own. I never stood on anyone's shoulders. I mean, that's so crazy because we all are born into a world that somebody else constructed. We didn't make this stuff. The world is here when we get here. Other people had to do that. So I think that kind of thinking really cuts off this very important kind of gratitude. But then when you start applying that as well to questions of, again, you know, who pays for it, this gets to the thing of public goods that you mentioned, right? What is a public good? It's something we all have a part of and something we potentially all benefit from. And therefore, to the extent that we can, we should all pay for it. And that's a reasonable thing to expect. We all contribute. We all benefit. That's wonderful. To take something like education, which is so clearly a public good, and to try to move that instead into this privatized realm where it becomes these discrete individuals. The student is the only one really benefiting. And people seem to have this attitude almost now, like students are taking advantage of society. They walk away with these expensive educations and the state pays for part of it. You know, it's on the public's bill. We have to pay for that. As if we didn't in any way benefit from the fact these people are getting education, as if we could just stop educating people and everything would be fine. That's insane. That's an insane view. But I keep encountering that view all over the place. And I think that student as customer model is a really big part of that.
That's the voice of Professor Troy Jalamore. I'm joined today by three academic philosophers, and we're discussing the issue of capitalism and consumerism and its infiltration into the higher education and education in general. John Sanbanmatsu, I wanted to come back to you, but before I did, I wanted to take a moment to editorialize myself and say, you know, with regard to the, John, something that you spoke about in your talk that you recently gave about reification. First of all, it seems to me what's clear and what fits perfectly with the neoliberal model is this notion, and Troy, you spoke about this, that only those things which are quantifiable and those things which can be indexed to some kind of cost-benefit analysis in real dollars are the things that are valuable, right? And this manifests itself, in my experience, in a number of ways. The student as customer, where the the teacher, you have these student evaluations and they have numbers and everything has to be quantified. And if it can't be quantified, then it really isn't, if it's not measurable by quantification, then it's not valuable. And I'm sure you've all had this experience as well. And for those listeners who either are in college, have students in, kids or relatives in college, when the student is asked at the end of a semester to quantify the educational experience, you know, their customer experience, and then these numbers are used as hard numbers to evaluate, that is the kind of thing where I want to say, when I think about, you know, history, when I think about my own life, and I think about so many times the most important and valuable and impressionable experiences I had were not easily assessed or quantified at the time when I had them, right? So it requires a little bit of perspective, a little bit of growth. So that's one aspect of this sort of reification of get the numbers and get the bottom line. I think the other aspect with regard to what you were saying earlier about the culpability or the sort of the faculty, the professors, the teachers being in confederacy with this neoliberalism. In my experience, especially at the university level, if you get a job, first of all, the university hires people with PhDs to teach. And the PhD process, most people go to a research school and they have to write a dissertation. The process itself of attaining a PhD in an American university is a process by which you learn many things, one of which is rule following. So in my experience, the PhD professor, that when you've gotten to the point where you've gotten a job at a university, it's been selected for that you follow rules. That's how you got there. Your margins on your dissertation were exactly what you followed all the rules, and then you have to get tenure. And to get tenure, you got to follow all the rules, and there's not a lot of room for upstarts. So the system itself, Peter, it sort of selects for, you're not going to have firebrands. You're not going to have mavericks going through and becoming professors. Of course there are, and I'm not saying that there aren't professors obviously in this call, there are on this program today, but in general, as a trend, I think to say, well, the faculty haven't really, they've been complicit, I think it might be selection bias. That's who gets the gigs, that's how you get the job, and then you have your eye on being a dean or moving up. So that's part of the problem too. But let me just be quiet and stop pontificating and circle back to John, Professor John Sanbonmatsu. John, what you've been listening to all of this stuff, and what are your ruminations at this point?
Well, unfortunately, I agree with what everyone has said, and I'm very thankful to all three of you for deepening this discussion, in order. Robert, thank you for giving a clear definition of the project of neoliberalism. I mean, it was really a deliberate kind of strategy by a group of intellectuals on the right, and they succeeded. As Troy has pointed out, in creating a new common sense of society. My friend Troy Vitese, no relation to this Professor Troy Gellimore. Troy's a historian. Vitese's a historian, and he's writing a book about this history of this process by which this handful of people has transformed the world. But I think kind of building on what you were saying, Peter, about the crisis of the imagination, I just think that's something we're all talking about. And I think that is so crucial. And to me, it's absolutely terrifying. When I talk to my students, it's exactly what you were saying, Troy, that they can't imagine, both of you, I think, were saying this, but they can't imagine another way of being. And how do you explain that? you know, and how can you explain what it's like to go into an independent bookseller, a bookstore, used bookstore, say, right? Or a repertory theater, right? We used to be able to go, like, here in the Boston area, there was a theater called the Orson Welles Cinema, you know, and there are a couple of these things left, but not the way there used to be. So civil society's been hollowed out. People don't have the same reference points. People don't watch the same TV shows. They don't watch the same YouTube influencers. My nephew, I asked him what he wanted to be, you know, when he was 8 years old, and he said he wanted to grow up to be a YouTube influencer. So that's the ground that we're working with. And if you don't have an informed citizenry or citizenry that has the same kind of common understanding of the world, then you can't really have a functional democracy. And the other problem of this is indeed reification. That's a kind of complex topic, but it is about the quantification of everything. And it's the cultural effects of reification, which, you know, were laid out in a book called History and Class Consciousness by Georg Lukács, the Marxist theorist, in 1923. Lukács describes this as a progressive disease that metastasizes and colonizes economics and philosophy and history. And it just sinks down into the consciousness of man, as quote unquote, as Lukács wrote. And what I see is, on the one hand, you've got artificial intelligence that's becoming more and more indistinguishable from human consciousness in as a simulation. I don't believe machines will ever be conscious, personally, and I think it's really important talk about that ontological difference. But the simulation of human behavior and so forth by the machine is becoming perfect. Meanwhile, humans are becoming more and more machine-like, right? This is a problem that was identified, you know, long ago by the Frankfurt School, critical theorists of the Frankfurt School, 1930s and 40s in particular, the early Frankfurt School, talking about the integration of the subject within this apparatus of control and domination. And of course, so this has been going on for quite a while, but there's something now that the subject has been so de-skilled. The students don't bother to read. None of the students in my class this term read books. They told me. I said, "Well, does anyone read?" No, they don't read books. They get all their information from YouTube, you know, and so they are exposed. And in a way, you know, Socrates in The Republic talks about when he's going over the different forms of government, and he gets to democracy. He was no fan of democracy, you know, but he talks about this kind of leveling down where all ideas are treated equally, as of equal importance. There's no longer a form of way to discriminate between truth claims. That's our moment. It's, of course, not a function of democracy. What's happened is that we have a democratization of the means of propaganda, a democratization of the means of, you know, lies and paranoia and violence and misogyny and racism. Yeah, that's the democracy that's going on, but not meaningful democracy. Certainly not economic democracy. So anyway, sorry to go on so long, but I'm just very frightened by what I see in my students, because they are depressed, they're demoralized, but they don't have any sense of historical possibility. And who can blame them at a moment of ecological apocalypse? All animal life on the earth is dying, and climate change isn't even the main cause of that. So the whole thing is coming apart. The liberal democratic state turns out to be a kind of temporary fix within capitalism. You have a legitimation crisis of democracy in the state, which is just coming apart. So there's not even state or authorized knowledge anymore, which had its own problems, but at least there was a sense of a common framework to either agree with or disagree with. And now it's just complete obliteration. And this is the final realization of capital. I mean, it was Thomas Hobbes, the English political theorist in the early 17th century, who wrote in Leviathan, what is the value of a man but his price? Well, you know, it took centuries, but now we have students branding themselves, and now we, you know, students are just our customer, we're et cetera, et cetera. And I totally agree with what you were saying, Troy, about how tragic it is that the student-professor relationship has been reduced to this the callous exchange relation, you know, and that relation being more and more mediated by money and by, in fact, not even just money, but by the logic of the commodity. That's the problem. And this is Lukasz's point about reification. It's that logic, a kind of cultural logic, that infects everything that we do, everything that we do. So anyway, I could go on, but I'm taking too much time on that.
Well, that's the voice of Professor John San van Matsu, and we're in a discussion about the neoliberalization of academia and in general of American society. And I want to go over to Professor Peter Fossil. You've been listening, and Peter, before you jump in, with regard to the public support as education as a common good, let me just quickly, I want to read just a one sentence quote from a book. The book is from 1776, and the quote is, quote, "The expense of the institutions for education and religious instruction is likewise no doubt beneficial to the whole society and may therefore, without injustice, be defrayed by the general contribution of the whole society." Those are the words of none other than Adam Smith, the father, supposed father of free market laissez-faire capitalism, who writes in The Wealth of Nations, when I teach this material, I always emphasize this. He's advocating for for education as a public good to be supported by the taxes. Anyway, Peter Fossil, let's go to you. What are your thoughts?
Gosh, so many. That's a great quote, by the way. And yeah, you know, most of my work is on early modernity, and it's often irksome to me how Smith gets misrepresented that way. Hume too, by the way. But about the common good, I guess I would say what comes to my mind is Margaret Thatcher's remark a long time ago that there is no society. There is only individuals. And that about sums it up. I mean, it's just the denial that there is anything larger than the individual and the individual's interests that we should be concerned about. I mean, I think many people don't realize, but for instance, I know that major public universities here in Kentucky receive now less than 10% of their funding from the state. They are over 90% privately funded. And most of that comes from students who are taking that out through debt, off sometimes government debt, but often the private debt. Spengler said, the author of Decline of the West, said that debt was one of our most powerful inventions. And my father used to tell me that debt is slavery. And I think, you know, that there is this project of indebting people as much as possible. But the absence of the common has certainly been at work a long time, and it's reaping what it's sowed now. I think as far as faculty responsibility goes, I want to touch on that quickly. I have two or three hypotheses about that. One is that we do a poor job in a practical sense within our institutions. Faculty often present themselves as kind of lefties, but I mean, they have 70% of our classes taught by contingent faculty who are way underpaid. Sometimes, often, you know, as John's pointed out, there was a job offered zero compensation. Was it UCLA or somewhere out there some time ago? Many contingent faculty work below the minimum wage. And these are people with PhDs, often highly trained people. And regular faculty aren't paid that well either. But we don't do a very good job within our institutions. We don't stand up for that. Or the staff. The staff, you know, I know workers here in the university who have pretty important jobs to make less than they make over in the Amazon warehouses here. So we do a poor job. I think one of the things, you're right, Robert, that the process of graduate school and tenure selects a certain type. It also tends to select loners. I think faculty, it's their individual CVs that matter to them, and their individual name on the spine of the book or the article. So we tend to be, we give lip service to collectivism, but we act as isolated actors. We want to be these individuals who are recognized for our genius in various ways, but we do a poor job acting collectively, even for our own benefit, really. Then there's also, I think, our retreat from the public world. Part of that, I am inclined to, you know, agree with someone like Terry Eagleton that a lot of post-structuralism and just academia recently are symptoms of late capitalism. And part of that has been this defeated, we've been defeated in many ways. And so we retreat from the public, very few of us who act as public intellectuals anymore. And we invest our ego into these prestige journals that very almost never get read, and these invited speaker appointments to, you know, speak to 20, 30 people in the university settings. And I think that's an abdication of our public responsibility too. We ought to be out there more acting as public intellectuals. Tenure committees, you know, of course, don't recognize public work, public intellectual work. And that's a bad thing. That's one way that that happens. And then lastly, this is probably a place where I know I'm going to deviate from John's epistemic concerns in a certain way, but before I get there, I want to say that I when I teach, I have this sort of pedagogy, what I call critical piety. And why I think critique is a really important thing that we do and teach. We don't do enough piety. And by that, I mean, think of ourselves as conduits of the treasures and accomplishments of our civilization. As Troy said, we ought to be grateful for a lot. We didn't come into this world with nothing here. It was built for us. But we give too little time. We spend too little time as teachers teaching that kind of gratitude, teaching that appreciation. We spend most of our time teaching about its shortcomings and its flaws. That ought to be taught. I have no gripe with that. But I think that we really could do a better job, because we've produced in some, I think we need to take responsibility for this, a backlash. And I think a reasonable backlash because of the excesses of our and our failure to communicate. I mean, capitalism, by the way, as many have pointed out, is not interested in, you know, considering the jewels of our traditions, intellectual traditions. Otherwise, capitalism, all it cares about is the next quarter's bottom line. And we know in cultures, it moves into cultures and tears them up and destroys their traditions and replaces them with Coca-Cola and shopping malls and what have you. But that happens here too. And we've facilitated that with our I think part of it is we want to pose as these knowing critics. We spend a lot of time, we get a lot of satisfaction thinking that we know what's wrong with the world. But we don't get enough satisfaction out of producing and communicating what's been, you know, the accomplishments of our world too. So those are some of my thoughts on, the epistemics. I did want to say to John, I don't know. I kind of feel the opposite. I think, you know, the appeal to the real and the true is usually what people do when they're losing. So, you know, you see this kind of thing like in the gender debates now, that gender is real. You know, that's what, it's almost like a substitute. You can substitute God for truth and real when people talk about science is real. I think it's just the opposite, that a lot of things we've seen show that truth is elusive. And really what we ought to be teaching people is to be less dogmatic. It's not that there's this fracturing, which is happening, but a loss of the common. I would say that people believe too strongly for bad reasons. And if we were to teach them anything, it'd be more skeptical of the sources that they're claiming these dogmatic beliefs from. And that partly is our the fault of big institutions. Troy and Robert will know this wrap, so I'll just give it too quickly. And that is, and your talk, John, by the way, I've heard your talk. I thought it was great how you connected Occupy Wall Street and the January 6th riots with the Sanders campaign and the fascism of the oppressed, you said, or the fascism of the lower classes, forget the phrase you used. But people I don't blame people for having have lost faith in the dominant institutions of the society. They've been treated badly by them over and over and over. And I find it kind of amusing sometimes people are saying like, they won't listen to us anymore. They won't believe us anymore. They won't, follow us anymore. Think about that. Think about why not. And it's often the explanation is, oh, they've been brainwashed by Fox News or something. I think it's a much broader failure, and that we academics are part of that failure. And I really appreciated that in your talk when you pointed that out, that broader failure of major institutions for many people in our country, I think is at the root of a lot of that resistance.
No, that's good. That's good. That's the voice of Professor Peter Fossil, and we're in the midst of a discussion about the capitalization or the corporatization, if you will, of education. I want to turn to Professor Troy Jalimore here at Chico State. Troy, you've been listening, taking notes, ruminating. Where are you coming from on this?
Well, it's so much to respond to here. Peter, thanks for bringing up again the student debt situation, which I just think is so revolting right now. I almost, as cynical and pessimistic as I am, I still find it hard to believe in a way that we've gotten to this point where we're willing to do this to our young people. It shocks me. I kind of thought at one point I'd lost the capacity to be shocked, but things keep happening that still shock me. So I guess I've still got it. This is one of them. Similarly, and you brought this up and it went by very quickly. We don't really have time, I think, to spend a lot of time on it. But yeah, the treatment of lecturers and the exploitation of the lecturer class by the university today is abhorrent. It's unbelievable. Again, and it only has a neoliberal economic justification. There's really nothing else to be said in favor of it. It's just a way of getting cheap labor, which you can dispose of as soon as you're done with it, or as soon as it's effective or cost saving to do it, and treat them badly. It's unbelievable to me that this even happens. So, I mean, that could be a whole show in itself. And we certainly had some things lately here at Chico State where we lost a lot of lecturers. And I know some of them personally who are really in a hard position right now. The way they've been treated by their employer is just, it's disgusting. It truly is. And I can't believe again that we put up with this. I wanted to go back in a more general way to the concept or the topic of reification that keeps coming up. And I'm so interested in that. Something I've thought a lot about. I don't know if you guys, I know Robert, you do, because we talked about it a little. If you know this philosopher, T. Nguyen, fascinating, very intelligent guy. Everything he writes, as far as I can tell, is good. I haven't read it all, but everything I've read is good. He's got a great paper called The Seductions of Clarity, where he writes about this current influence of what he refers to as false clarity, of giving people the feeling that they understand something without really giving them genuine understanding, and how, for instance, getting people hooked on quantified explanations and quantified measures is a way of doing that, where, there's reasons for doing it in a bureaucratic setting, and it's not even that he's completely against them, but they so easily get taken too far and get treated as if they're the only real measurements. And the amount of information that gets lost when we do that is huge. I brought in something from the online site that we're all familiar with, ratemyprofessor.com, because I was looking at it recently, not my own page, which I never do, and I'm much happier since I made that vow. But for some reason, I was looking at it a couple of years ago, and I checked to see if this is still true, and it was. When you rate somebody, you are allowed to write a short blurb. Of course, the main thing about it is the number you give them. But then there's also tags, and it suggests a bunch of tags for you. So I think, so that you don't have to come up with something yourself or whatever. It says, well, here are things you might say about your professor. And so it's all little things like tough grader, get ready to read, extra credit, amazing lectures, clear grading criteria, lots of homework and so on. Beware of pop quizzes. What's notable first, most of all, on this list of tags that they suggest is the absences. Like in particular, unless you count amazing lectures, maybe that's the one that could be read this way, but I really doubt that's the way they intended. Outside of that, none of these others could even be possibly read as really being about how much you learn in a class. Like, how much are you being taught? What did I come away from in this class? You would think that maybe some students at least would care about that and what they're getting out of their classes. Like, what did I learn? It's not even a suggested rating category on Rate My Professor. In fact, with only a couple of exceptions, so there's hilarious, for instance, so how entertaining were they? You know, compare them with what you watched on Netflix last night. Or online savvy, I think that one's really interesting. How good are they at using the technology? Like, that's one of the things. They don't suggest that you rate your professor in terms of how much they can teach and how much they understand or how knowledgeable they are. But in terms of how well they can use the IT technology, that's insane, I think. Outside of that, almost everything on here, I guess there's caring and inspirational. Those are nice. Okay. The large majority of suggested tags are about grades themselves. What kind of grade are you going to be likely to get in this course? And how hard you're going to have to work for it. And so I think this is this amazing thing where, first of all, you've got this piece of technology widely, widely used. We all know about it. A lot of people, I think, make their decisions this way. They take it seriously. They regard it as sort of giving them objective knowledge in a way. You know, it's on the internet and so on. It in itself is doing this sort of inappropriately quantifying thing of just putting numbers on professors as if that tells you how good they are and if you should take their courses. And then as you're doing this, you know, so that's the one level. And the second level is as you're doing the evaluating and so on, it's using these categories to sort of funnel your comments into this very narrow range of possible responses. I think it's incredible. And this isn't a plot by anybody. It's not like the people, I'm sure, who made this website sat down and said, how can we advance the cause of neoliberalism and so on with our website? It's just that, again, these things are so internalized that they're almost self-perpetuating at this point. These kind of mechanisms, not only, you know, they're shaped by these things, these value assumptions, but they also end up embodying them and replicating them. It's just horrifying to me.
You know, and I find that even in some of my colleagues, I've been surprised to hear that describe the board of trustees as the owners of the university and us as employees. I'm like, they're not the owners. They're not board of directors. They're trustees. And they're here to serve us. You know, we're not their employees. They're our servants, right? And we and the students are the mission here. It's not turning a profit for shareholders. It's not, you know, training people for employment. You know, educating people is the output, if you will, of the university. And that's the goal. And bringing the classics and bringing literature and bringing philosophy and bringing the arts and creating a site where people can come and experience these things, learn these things, treasure these things. That's our value. But even my colleagues don't often get that. Many of my colleagues have bought into the consumer model, and it can be difficult. It can be difficult. But yeah, I think that letter—that's a really great point you make.
I've saved it ever since it came out, and I read it. I so agree with you. But you know, we live in a society where people think that hospitals should be profit-making ventures, and the prisons should be profit-making ventures. They've lost the idea that there could be anything that is not oriented and therefore measured by simply how much profit does it make. And you see the results. They're all around us.
And the government's job is to get the economy growing, you know, and yeah, maximize the stock market and things like that. You know, right?
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's the voice of Professor Peter Fossil, and preceding that, Professor Troy Jollimore. Well, Professor John Sanborn Matsu, the impetus for this roundtable discussion on today's program came from your work and your talk on the neoliberalization of academia. And as we head towards the end of our hour here, I want to give you the last word. If you could give us some words of wisdom as we try to digest this discussion of neoliberalism.
It is customary in these matters to end on a hopeful note and to point out that with the contradictions being what they are and hegemony having its fissures of dissent, that, you know, we mustn't give up hope. But I don't believe that. I mean, I think that I don't see a way out of this crisis, this historical crisis at the moment. I hope I'm wrong, but I just see things getting far, far, far worse than they already are. That said, you know, on the positive side, you know, University of California graduate workers just went on strike this last week, historically unprecedented, 48,000 workers on strike. And so, you know, the impetus for freedom and for people to resist this structure is that will continue. But in the absence of a strategic, coherent, ideologically coherent movement or set of movements to overthrow capitalism speciesism, patriarchy, these structures of mass violence and domination, you know, it's kind of spitting in the wind, to be honest. I do want to just say, you know, I want to thank all three of you for your really insightful comments. And both Peter and Troy, I just want to piggyback on what you were saying about the, oh, and you too, Robert, about, you know, the process of academia, right? And the way the faculty are implicated in this. And we find, you know, there's the haves and the have-nots, just as in capitalist society as a whole. And I've noticed that the most courageous people on my campus tend to be the ones who don't have tenure, ones who are the most precarious. They are the ones who are often the most outspoken, whereas some of my tenured colleagues are very, I don't want to say smug, but they have been socialized into rule following, as you put it, Robert, and in a kind of conformism, and they've become part of the solution and not part of, part of the problem, not part of the solution, as the saying used to go, you know. And so there's a larger crisis of knowledge in society and including academic knowledge. Pierre Bourdieu in, his book, Homo Economicus, you know, talks about this. Homo economicus becomes, what is it? I'm sorry, Homo academicus. Homo academicus. Homo academicus becomes Homo mediocritus. In other words, it's a kind of, you know, the production. This is another symptom of reification. Just have to churn out all of these ridiculous, more and more micro-disciplinized, obscure, specialized papers that, as you say, you know, no one will read. But then, you know, you add it to your CV. And so the length of your CV, is the sign of your marketability and your value and so on and so forth. So it's another trap. So there are all of these forces impinging on us. And, I don't know that I have much anything inspiring to say, except that I think it's really great that you had this. We're having this discussion today, and there's, as your listeners will have figured out, there are just so many dimensions to this, so many moving parts, and it's really urgent that society reflect on what's happening to education in our country and elsewhere. And it isn't, of course, just higher education; it's just the, you know, the rote learning that goes on in schools and the destruction of the humanities and social sciences in elementary schools and so forth. It's just a huge problem. So thank you for having us all today.
Well, thank you, Professor John Sanbonmatsu, for joining us. Professor Peter Fossil and Professor Troy Jollimore, thank you for a stimulating discussion. I can't say I feel very uplifted about the future of academia and the role that neoliberalism plays, but we have to keep up the good fight. The fact that we're having this conversation, there is some resistance, and as you mentioned, Professor John Sanbonmatsu, this we as we broadcast, we're in the midst of a graduate student strike with the UC, an unprecedented strike. So there are glimmers of hope within the dark blanket of the late capitalist neoliberal move in all of academia. But I want to thank all three of you for joining me today on the Peace and Social Justice program.
Thank you all.
Thanks, that was great.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Baker's Birkenstock, featuring more than 40 brands of footwear, socks, purses, and hats. Baker's Birkenstock has been serving our community for over 40 years with locations at 333 Broadway Street in downtown Chico and at 691 First Street in Paradise, also on Facebook.
That's it for this week's edition of Peace and Social Justice. This episode was written, recorded, edited, mixed, and produced by me, Robert Jones. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. All the music heard on today's program was written and performed by and used with permission from my friend, Los Angeles-based drummer and composer, Chris Wabich. You can hear more of Chris Wabich's music at bandcamp.com. Stay tuned for Playing Dead, which is coming right up. And remember, continue to seek peace while fighting systems of injustice wherever and whenever you can. Until next time, goodbye and take care.
All right. Thank you, Robert, for yet another wonderful program on Peace and Justice. My name's Ray Lager. I will be your host today on Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. Got a little throwback for you today. Of course, they're all throwback shows. That's right, Ray. Wake up. We are going to play. We are going to May 3rd, 1986. Cal Expo right down there in Sacktown. nice landing spot for the boys, that's for sure. They did some nice shows there, and we'll get right to it with a very...